Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hey everybody, it's Nicole Byer here with some hot takes from Wayfair. A cozy corduroy sectional from Wayfair? Yeah, that's a hot take. Go on and add it to your cart and take it. A pink glam nightstand from Wayfair? Scalding hot take. Take it before I do. A mid-century modern cabinet from Wayfair that doubles as a wine bar? Do I have to say it? It's a hot take. Get it at Wayfair.com and enjoy that free shipping too.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Lock your doors. Close the blinds. Change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This podcast is produced and hosted by Chris Carr.
On today's podcast, we're joined by author and investigative journalist Tim Tate, and he discusses his latest book, To Catch a Spy, which looks at how the spycatcher affair brought MI5 in from the cold, as the then Thatcher government of the 1980s tried to silence MI5 whistleblower Peter Wright and hide the truth about Britain's intelligence services and the political elite. This is a really fascinating story of state-sanctioned cover-ups, government lying to parliament and courts around the world, and of stories leaked with the intention to mislead and deceive. I really enjoyed chatting with Tim and I found our conversation truly fascinating, and I hope you do as well. Just before we begin, if you're enjoying this podcast, please consider supporting us directly by becoming a Patreon subscriber. All you need to do is just go to patreon.com/secretsandspies. And depending on which level you pick, you'll get a free coaster or coffee cup. And also you'll get access to our Patreon exclusive show, Extra Shot, which comes out twice a month after every espresso martini.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
Tim, welcome back to the podcast. I believe this is your third visit now.
Grief, is it? Thank you very much for having me.
It's great to have you back on. I think last time I spoke with you, we were obviously talking about espionage, and I think you were telling me about the level of coffee and cigarettes you'd had in the National Archives whilst researching your previous book.
Yeah, it's a regular habit for me, I'm afraid.
Not to worry. Well, it seems to be yielding really good results. So you have a new book called To Catch a Spy, which we'll go into shortly. But for listeners who may not have heard our previous interviews or know much about you, please can you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm an investigative journalist, a documentary filmmaker, and a widely published author. And I've been a journalist working in one or other of those media, sometimes all at once, for 45 years. I've made more than 80 films for all British terrestrial networks, plus various international broadcasters. I've written for most national newspapers. And prior to this book, I've published 18 previous books, all with mainstream commercial publishers.
Fantastic. Well, before we discuss the specifics of your latest book, To Catch a Spy, can you explain a little bit about why you wrote it and how you went about researching it, and maybe even how many coffees and cigarettes you consumed whilst researching it as well?
Oh, I think I'd need a calculator for the latter. Well, my previous book, which we discussed, as you said, on the podcast, was a biography of the Cold War super spy Mikhail Golyanovsky. And Peter Wright, who was then a very senior MI5 officer, identified Golyanovsky as one of the most important Soviet bloc spies working for the West ever. And he had written about some of Golyanovsky's revelations.
Mm.
And it was this, he wrote about them in his book, Spycatcher, which we'll come to. It was this plus my own recollections, my own memories of the truly enormous international furore surrounding the British government's doomed efforts to suppress Wright's troublesome book, Spycatcher, which made me wonder, was there a deeper story behind the seemingly endless succession of court battles the British government fought to silence Wright? And, spoiler alert, there was a deeper story, and then some.
Indeed, indeed. Well, what were the... You were the, was it the National Archives and various other archives that you used for researching this book?
National Archives here, the US National Archives, the Polish Institute of National Remembrance, all of that for the previous book.
Now, one thing that's of interest maybe to an international audience is the Official Secrets Act. And I was going to talk about it in sort of two parts. The first part will be the sort of 70s and 80s, kind of the era of Peter Wright and how it was sort of used, and it was sort of the use of it was sort of semi-inconsistent. Can you talk to us a little bit about the Official Secrets Act?
Sure. I mean, the Official Secrets Act dated back to before the First World War, and it was passed amid a public panic about suspected German spies operating in Britain. That act had a notorious catch-all clause, which made it an offence, a criminal offence, for anyone employed by the government to reveal any information, official information, however trivial, which they'd acquired during their service. And, you know, this didn't just cover spies or matters of national security. Quite literally, any information, down to the menus in staff canteens in government offices, was an official secret. But if that was the letter of the law, it was rarely actually invoked. And a succession of former intelligence officers from MI5 and MI6 had published their memoirs without any real interference. And in fact, in the very year that Wright joined MI5 in 1955, the former Director General, Sir Percy Sillitoe, former Director General of MI5, published his memoirs. Beyond that, the Security Service, MI5, and the Secret Intelligence Service, MI6, leaked like sieves. Individual officers briefed journalists, they placed stories in newspapers, and occasionally gave on-the-record interviews in which they were quoted by name, rank, and the service for which they worked. And all of this would, when the government sought to silence Peter Wright, prove immensely problematic.
Indeed. And how do the Official Secrets Act sort of change today? Because obviously in the US, and this podcast benefits from this, there are a lot of former intelligence officers who write memoirs to this day, and there's a process in the US where a former CIA officer can kind of submit the book for official review, and then they will take out anything that sort of might explain an ongoing operation or something that might be considered dangerous to national security. But in the UK, we don't seem to sort of, it doesn't appear like we have a system, because we don't get many spy memoirs. I don't think we've had any spy memoirs in recent times. And if anything, the SAS books of the early 90s, like Bravo 20 etc., might well have sort of changed things and made things even more difficult for would-be former intelligence officers to write memoirs. So I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about the kind of current situation.
Sure. Before we do, you mentioned the CIA and its officers and contract agents sometimes being enabled, indeed encouraged, to write books about their experiences, provided they're submitted via the official publications review board. Now, that situation applied at the time of Spycatcher, the Spycatcher trials in the 1980s. And indeed, it was one of the things which was raised within the trials by Peter Wright's defense lawyers. They said quite rightly, look, the CIA does this. We have offered, the lawyers for Peter Wright and Heinemann, the publishers, have offered on behalf of them to vet anything, to give you the book to vet, and you take out anything which is severely damaging. Why can't we do that? And they never got a coherent answer, to put it mildly. The position in the UK today, it's an interesting question, and I'm not sure there is a hard and fast answer to it. You know, to get an understanding of what has or may have changed, we need to remember that at the time Wright joined MI5, when he retired and when he set about publishing Spycatcher, both MI5 and MI6 did not officially exist, because neither service was avowed. In other words, the British government maintained, particularly over MI6, this bizarre pretense that we didn't have a domestic, much less a foreign, intelligence service. And when Wright joined MI5, it was made clear to him that he was employed not by the government, but by the Crown, under an ancient and unwritten royal prerogative. And that meant there was no employment contract, and he most certainly had no employment rights. There was nothing apart from the Official Secrets Act that in fact formally said an officer could not speak about what he'd learned. And all of that would prove one of the major legal obstacles for the British government in its labyrinthine attempts to prevent publication of spy catchers. While English courts were ready, willing and able to enforce this, enforce the Official Secrets Act, Wright was then living in Tasmania. And neither the Official Secrets Act nor the royal prerogative could be enforced in courts outside the United Kingdom. And that meant that he, or any other troublesome spy, could legally write his or her memoirs and publish them from the safety of an overseas bolt hole. One of the effects of the Spycatcher debacle, which was an extraordinary combination of sort of high treason and low farce, was that the British government was finally forced, over Margaret Thatcher's vehement objections, to put both MI5 and MI6 on a statutory basis with actual contracts of employment. In theory, that could make it easier for the government today to prevent ex-intelligence officers from publishing unauthorised books, newspaper articles, or giving broadcast interviews. But I'm not sure this has ever been tested, or whether any government today would want to run the risk of the international ridicule and opprobrium which Thatcher's doomed attempts to silence Wright attracted. So whether a modern-day Peter Wright could publish a 21st century Spycatcher, I simply don't know.
No. The closest to it was probably a book by Richard Tomlinson called The Big Breach that came out, I think, in, was it 2000, 2001? And there was a sort of similar kind of debacle with that. And I believe it might have even been a Russian publishing house that actually published the book. And I know only in the last couple of years that the money that the book had made was finally released, so Richard Tomlinson could get access to the money he'd been owed for that book. That's the kind of closest I can think of, but I think there's some quite big differences between that and Spycatcher. But
and you know, that's also 21 years ago. 23 yeah. years ago, I'm sorry.
Yes, yes, indeed, indeed.
I think it's anyone's guess, because it's not just a question of law, it's a question of politics, as Spycatcher was. It was both law and politics. And, you know, politics being the art of the possible, whether a modern-day government, a 21st century government, would be stupid enough to repeat the exercise which Thatcher's government embarked upon against all good advice, I think is an open question at best.
Yeah. And what is the sort of situation with the sort of declassification of files these days? Because I think, am I right, in the archives, you can't get past sort of files from, is it the 60s or 70s with regards to MI5 and MI6?
Well, that's a whole other bag of snakes. we passed, after Spycatcher, the Freedom of Information Act was brought in. And in fact, you know, at least to some small degree, Spycatcher helped usher that in. It specifically excluded the intelligence services from its provisions. So you can't submit a Freedom of Information Act request to MI5 or MI6 at all. And there is no obligation on either service to publish anything from its files, however old. In fairness, and I think to its credit, MI5 does voluntarily release some files at its own and entirely unfathomable whim after they've reached their 50th birthday. But you have no right to say, I want these, I want to see these. We may have paid for them, but we have no right to see them. And all the files on Spycatcher and all the espionage scandals from the 50s and 60s, which so exercised right, all MI5's files, or most of MI5's files on those, remain locked away.
Wow. Well, we've mentioned the man a few times himself, Peter Wright. Can you talk to us a little bit about who he was and what is sort of known about his career in MI5?
Sure. First and foremost, Peter Wright was a boffin. You know, he was a largely self-taught but highly innovative scientist. During and after the Second World War, he worked for the Royal Naval Scientific Service. But in the early 1950s, he had some very real success in that role. But in the early 1950s, he also worked unpaid and in his own time for MI5 at its request. And he achieved some very real successes in doing so, particularly in uncovering the mysteries of a then completely unknown microphone which the Soviets had invented, which bypassed all of the cumbersome wiring and which they'd installed happily in the Great Seal of the United States in the American embassy in Moscow. Wright, as this innovative but not formally qualified scientist, unpicked its mysteries, worked out how it worked, and created a British and American prototype version, which we duly put into service. And it was a very great innovation. After that, in 1955, he was formally appointed as MI5's first ever in-house scientific officer. And he and his genuine scientific genius, was very much needed, because at the time MI5 was largely unfit for purpose. It had achieved very real successes during World War II, but then had been left to moulder and was quite unprepared for the new and largely electronic battleground of the Cold War. On top of which, it was utterly lawless. Because it didn't officially exist, there were no legal controls on what MI5 officers got up to, and that left Wright and his colleagues free to break the law wholesale. You know, they broke into offices, embassies, private houses. They copied people's keys to enable them to do that. They learnt how to pick locks. They placed anyone they were interested in, foe or even notionally friend, under surveillance. Telephone tapping, mail surveillance. As Wright put it in Spycatcher, we bugged and burgled our way across London while pompous bowler-hatted civil servants looked the other way. But, there's always a but, the service, and in Wright's view, the entire British establishment, also had a substantial in-house problem. Because from the 1930s onwards, Moscow's intelligence services had recruited young British men and women, often at the country's leading universities, and they had progressed to careers in government, the civil service, sensitive industries, and both MI5 and MI6. They were, bluntly, moles, people who betrayed their country's secrets and the intelligence services operations against the Soviet bloc to Moscow. From the late 1950s, Wright was officially tasked by MI5, for whom he worked, with finding them. And this moved him away from his primary expertise, science. And for the next 20 years, he was MI5's most determined and passionate and, in some cases, brilliant, in some cases less than brilliant, mole hunter. Even when this involved him uncovering Soviet spies inside the government, the establishment, and the intelligence services themselves. And that quest, that task, if you like, led to no end of trouble.
Yes. Yes. Well, it's the infamous Wilderness of Mirrors from James Jesus Angleton, isn't it?
Yeah, who crops up from James Jesus Angleton, the shadowy, wraith-like head of counterintelligence for the CIA. He crops up throughout the Spycatcher saga, and his influence, largely malign, played a big role at times in both the effort to reveal what MI5 had been up to and the British government's cover-up.
Well, what was it that led Peter Wright specifically to sort of writing Spycatcher? And you mentioned he obviously had to go to Australia to do it. Can you talk to us a bit about that?
Sure. By the time he retired from MI5 in 1976, Wright was convinced that the service itself and large swathes of the establishment had been penetrated by Russian moles. You know, after 20 years investigating at MI5's explicit behest the 1930 spy rings, the espionage scandals of Anthony Blunt, Kim Philby, and the defections of Guy Burgess and Donald MacLean, Wright had identified at least 35 eminent, his word, other figures who could, and in his view should, have been prosecuted or at least publicly exposed as Soviet agents. And according to testimony he gave in a secret session during the Spycatcher trials, all of these 35 eminent people were listed in MI5's files as, quotes, having been Russian spies. That, you know, that's a direct quote from his secret evidence, which I got hold of. And he listed their names in a separate and even more closely guarded written annex to this secret evidence. Wright had tried for years to get variously MI5 and Downing Street to do something about this, but he had been repeatedly rebuffed, and that in his mind strengthened the case for, as he put it, the establishment being, quotes, rotten to the core. And it's another direct quote from his secret testimony. After he left MI5 and emigrated to set up a horse stud in Tasmania, he began tinkering away on a manuscript outlining what he called the cancer in our midst, Soviet penetration.
Mm.
He first tried to get this into the hands of Margaret Thatcher after she became Prime Minister, believing wrongly, as it turned out, that MI5 had withheld the information from her. Now, that effort was blocked, primarily by Sir Robert Armstrong, Thatcher's ambitious and, I have to say, oily cabinet secretary. At the same time, and we're talking now 1979, early 1980, a small rash of books by journalists began to expose some of MI5's previously concealed scandals, and primarily that the treachery of Sir Anthony Blunt. Now, in case anyone needs a quick primer on Blunt, he was a Cambridge Don, academic, who had been Moscow's chief recruiter in the 1930s and who, at the beginning of World War II, joined MI5 as a very senior officer. In fact, he became the deputy to the Director General. He used that position to feed British intelligence secrets to Russia's spy masters. After the war, he joined the royal family's household, the royal family's household, this is, as surveyor of the King's pictures, and later held the same and other positions on behalf of the Queen. But since the mid-1950s, MI5 knew he had been, and very possibly remained, a Soviet intelligence agent. But they had no actual evidence, and Blunt denied it repeatedly. Then, in 1964, the service was given explicit evidence by an American man whom Blunt had recruited at Cambridge University. But instead of arresting Blunt, MI5, with the then government's backing, gave him immunity from prosecution, provided he confessed to all that he knew and all that he had done. Peter Wright led the interrogations of Blunt for 8 years, and if Blunt was very far from frank during the interviews, it gave Wright enough evidence to support his belief that that Soviet penetration was vast, deep, and ongoing. But fast forward to 79, with the Thatcher government refusing to listen, he began thinking about writing a book.
Mm.
At which point the plot becomes very muddy indeed. Wright's old mentor was Lord Victor Rothschild, a former MI5 officer during World War II. In fact, he had been the man who recommended Anthony Blunt to MI5. Rothschild became deeply enmeshed after leaving the service in the post-war fabric of politics, science, and industry. If anyone should notionally have discouraged Peter Wright from writing his memoirs or a book, it would and should have been Victor Rothschild. Instead, he encouraged it. And he hooked Wright up with a notorious intelligence journalist, a man called Chapman Pincher. And the three of them together conspired, if you like, but worked out a deal in which Wright would provide the information about MI5 scandals from his personal experience. Chapman Pincher would write it up in a book which would be published under his, Pincher's name, and Rothschild would funnel right share of the proceeds to him in Tasmania via Rothschild's numerous offshore bank accounts. That book, which was the precursor, if you like, to Spycatcher, was called Their Trade is Treachery. It was published in 1981, and it exposed MI5's greatest secret, that the security service had investigated its own director general, Sir Roger Hollis, as a suspected Russian spy, a mole within MI5 itself.
Yeah.
The government knew about the book and its contents in advance. They knew that Wright was Pincher's chief source of information and that Rothschild was the book's impresario. All of this clearly broke the Official Secrets Act. No ifs, no buts, no maybes. Yet the government did nothing to block the book. And there was a reason for this. The reason is that at quite literally the same time as Rothschild brought Pincher together with Wright, Thatcher and her cabinet secretary, Sir Robert Armstrong, conspired to have Pincher briefed on the Hollis scandal by a former attorney general. The two of them, and we know this because I have the government papers which show this, said, how do we defuse the Hollis scandal? I know, let's leak it out via the pen of a tame journalist, a man we can control. They knew the scandal was bound to emerge, and they believed that Pincher, who was a tried and tested security service asset in his own right, could be trusted to break it safely, that is, with a high dose of pro-government spin, and thereby cause the least possible damage.
Mm.
It was, you know, it was an unprecedented plot by the Prime Minister and her most senior civil servant to leak the most sensitive and damaging secret in MI5's history to a journalist in the hope of gaining political advantage. It didn't quite work out the way they'd hoped. Pincher played fast and loose with Downing Street and with Wright. He splashed the Hollis scandal in the most dramatic way possible, and thus negating Thatcher and Armstrong's hope for a nice, safe little expose. But he betrayed Wright by insisting, well, there was actually no need for any inquiry into what had gone on. And that infuriated Wright. Thatcher added fuel to this fire, in Wright's view, by deliberately lying to the House of Commons. She was forced to make a statement once Pincher's book came out, and she told MPs that Hollis had been cleared of being a Russian spy by internal inquiries. He hadn't. As official documents released just at New Year 2023 revealed, that's more than four decades after the Spycatcher trials, those documents showed that the internal inquiry, the final internal inquiry, had concluded that there was a 20% chance that Hollis was indeed a Russian mole. After Their Trade is Treachery, more books, more magazine articles, television documentaries all followed on, all exposed yet more MI5 scandals, and former security service officers appeared on camera or wrote first-person accounts. Wright himself gave a lengthy on-camera interview to World in Action, which was then ITV's flagship investigative programme. Neither he nor any of the other officers, much less any of the media outlets, was ever prosecuted. 18 months later, infuriated by what he saw as Thatcher's misleading of the House of Commons, and determined to expose the cancer of Soviet penetration as he saw it, he decided to write his own book. And he asked the World in Action producer, Paul Greengrass, to co-author it. That book was Spycatcher. And unlike any other book, print story or TV documentary, Thatcher and Armstrong were determined to block its publication.
Mm.
And you have to ask why.
Mm. Well, let's take a quick break and then we'll be right back.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hey everybody, it's Nicole Byer here with some hot takes from Wayfair. A cozy corduroy sectional from Wayfair? Yeah, that's a hot take. Go on and add it to your cart and take it. A pink glam nightstand from Wayfair? Scalding hot take. Take it before I do. A mid-century modern cabinet from Wayfair that doubles as a wine bar? Do I have to say it? It's a hot take. Get it at Wayfair.com and enjoy that free shipping too.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.
With Spycatcher, what were the kind of main revelations in the book? Obviously, Sir Roger Hollis comes up quite a bit there. Can you give us a kind of quick overview of just what it was in this book with Sir Roger Hollis's sort of allegations?
The first thing to say about Spycatcher is that it exposed almost nothing that hadn't been previously published.
Mm.
You know, that's one of the great ironies of this. By the time Wright and Greengrass wrote and published Spycatcher, just about all the secrets that Wright had to tell were out. You know, they'd come out primarily in the book he helped Chapman Pincher write, Their Trade is Treachery, and then in a succession of newspaper articles, documentaries, magazine pieces, which followed on from that. There were some revelations, though they were no great surprise. You know, as I say, he talked about his days bugging and burgling across London, but then again, we'd known that. He talked about operations against friendly countries, the embassies of friendly countries, which were utterly illegal under international law. You know, we bugged the French communications at a time when Britain was trying to get into the what was then the European Economic Community, the Common Market. A gross breach of international law. But MI5 and Peter Wright did it. He talked about that. But above all, he talked about the penetration problem. This is what drove him. He talked about the Soviet spies who had been in place since the 1930s, who had worked their way up through the establishment, civil service government, MI5 and MI6. And he talked about Hollis. Well, Roger Hollis, in the 1920s and 1930s, worked variously in international banking as a freelance journalist and for British American Tobacco, and he travelled widely across China and in Russia. He joined MI5 in 1938, and during the Second World War and then afterwards, he rose steadily through the ranks of the service. In 1956, he became Director General, the head of the security service itself, and he stayed in post until he retired in 1965. For the last 2 years of his tenure, and then again after his retirement, he was formally investigated by MI5 as, their words, not mine, a suspected Russian spy. The main investigation was carried out by an internal working party of MI5 and MI6 officers called the Fluency Committee. The chairman of that committee was Peter Wright. You know, it's hard to overstate the importance of this. It was an utterly unprecedented investigation.
Yeah.
Never before, and never since, had Britain's most senior domestic spy been investigated as a suspected traitor. You know, a lot has been written about the case, and after Pincher's book with Wright, Their Traitor's Treachery, was published, Thatcher delivered this lengthy statement to Parliament exonerating Hollis, who was in any event by then long dead. And the various published stories and Thatcher's statement all have one thing in common. They're mostly bunk. How do we know? Primarily because of Wright's evidence in the spycatcher trials, both the testimony given in open court and that which was heard at the government's behest behind closed doors, and which I obtained for this book, for my book. Wright was convinced that Hollis was a spy and that he had been protected during and after the formal investigations. And you could say, you know, as many people have since, that this was just Wright. This was just Peter Wright. This was the ramblings of an old and embittered ex-spook who had an unjustified bee in his bonnet about unearthing moles. And you know, there is some truth in that. But official files, government files, declassified after decades, within, you know, and we're talking within the last 2 or 3 years, show that the government knew that Wright and Fluency had a very good reason for suspecting Hollis, and that far from being cleared, as Thatcher had claimed in Parliament, and this again is an official MI5 internal document sent to Number 10. Hollis was one of only two candidates for the mole who had most certainly penetrated the security service. The other was his deputy. You know, now those documents, which were only released in 2018, explicitly ruled that the best which could be said was the case against Hollis was not proven. Beyond that, the final attempt at a posthumous inquiry, and this, as I said, this information was disclosed just 7 months ago, reached the conclusion that there was a 20% chance that Hollis had been a Soviet mole and that he had betrayed Britain's secrets to Moscow. Previous accounts, post-Wright, argued that most of the suspicion was ill-founded and ill-intentioned, and that it was conspiracy theorising stemming from James Jesus Angleton, there's that man again, and his troublesome Soviet defector Anatoly Golitsyn, a former intelligence officer. The truth is that very little of what Wright worked on and the conclusions he reached came from Galitzin. Instead, there were 28 separate pieces of evidence. They're what MI5 calls serials. Wright found this during his official inquiries into other cases. You know, the names of those cases are simply too numerous to mention. All the details, should anyone want them, are set out in my book, along with where you can find the files for them. But they explained to Wright a mystery which had nagged at him throughout his career.
Mm.
As he testified in the Spycatcher trials, every operation which MI5 had launched against Soviet intelligence during Hollis's years in position of power had failed. Only after Hollis retired, says Wright, did MI5 start having any real success.
Interesting. And the way you sort of describe the committee investigating Sir Roger Hollis reminds me a little bit of obviously Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, the John le Carre novel that was sort of written in that kind of era, really. Many believe it's about Kim Philby, but there might be a Roger Hollis connection to it. Who knows?
I mean, unfortunately, John le Carre is now dead, so you can't ask him.
No, unfortunately not. I don't know, there'd be something in his archive somewhere, but very interesting. And am I right as well? Peter Wright obviously was involved with another MI5 officer called Arthur Martin, and Arthur Martin believed that there might have even been another Russian agent who was either active or had just recently sort of retired from the security services around sort of the sort of late 70s, early 80s.
Martin was, I'm trying to think of the right word, but he was essentially Wright's sort of predecessor and then collaborator in the mole hunt. All the earliest attempts by MI5 to locate traitors in its midst had been led by Arthur Martin, who was a bright, talented sleuth, if you like. He and Wright worked together from the early 1960s onward until Martin, who I don't think suffered fools gladly particularly, nor did Peter Wright, had a fallout with Sir Roger Hollis, surprisingly enough, over the mole hunting, and got kicked out of MI5 and joined MI6. It wouldn't be the end of his story, but for the moment it is. Martin and Wright had one, other than their unshakable belief that Britain had been penetrated by Soviet moles and that MI5 and MI6 had been as well, they had one particular thing in common. They were certainly regarded as NCOs by the officer class which ran MI5. You know, there was a very clear class division, Martin and Wright were the NCOs. You know, that we don't necessarily listen to them because they're not of our class. And that you can see that running through all the belatedly disclosed files. You know, this attitude that they weren't quite to be trusted because they weren't of the right class, and Wright's utter frustration with this. Yes, Martin believed, as did Wright, that there were other moles, and you know, I don't think anyone has ever argued that, or not convincingly, that Hollis, if it was Hollis, was the only mole. You know, if there were moles, there were likely to have been others. On the balance of probability, I think you have to say Wright and Martin could well have been right. But as Wright put it, which I think was a sensible way of putting it, where there is that level of doubt, remember, 20% versus, it was a 20% possibility that Hollis had been a Soviet agent, Wright said, in cases like that, I think the country has to be given the benefit of the doubt, not the individual. And you know, that, I think, summed up his attitude all the way through. He was, for all his faults, and they were legion, a deeply, deeply patriotic man.
Yeah. Could you talk just a little bit about the Harold Wilson plot, which is still officially denied today, I believe?
Well, it is and it isn't. The Harold Wilson, the Wilson plot, or more accurately, plots, because there were probably four, this is the counterside to Wright as the heroic figure in this saga. The plots against Wilson began not with Wright. They began much, or well, the interest in Harold Wilson, shall we say, by MI5, began in the 1940s when it opened a file on him. He was then an up-and-coming young politician in the Attlee government. It opened a file on him under the title Norman John Worthington. That was the code name it gave. And the reason it opened the file was that he had been in charge officially and tasked by Attlee, then Prime Minister, with selling advanced jet fighter engines to the Soviet Union. MI5 didn't like that. And although Wilson hadn't made the decision, Attlee had made the decision, they said, well, we're going to open file on him. So they did. After that, and this is where the plots and the conspiring really begin to gather pace, in 1963, the leader of the Labour Party, who was then expected to win the general election, which was coming within a year, was Hugh Gaitskell, and he was on the right of the party. He died unexpectedly in slightly mysterious circumstances a few weeks after coming back from a meeting in the Kremlin. And he died of an autoimmune disease, lupus. The belief, and was a reason for this belief, was that he had been poisoned by the KGB. Somehow it had managed in this telling to put something in his tea or his coffee that he had biscuits in the Kremlin. And the source of this allegation, the sources were our old friend, James Jesus Angleton from the CIA, and his favourite Soviet defector, Anatoly Golitsyn. They peddled this story that the KGB had poisoned Gaitskell to insert its own agent as his successor, as leader of the Labour Party and putative Prime Minister, and that successor was Harold Wilson. So MI5 opened another file on these allegations. This one was codenamed Oatsheaf. There was precisely no evidence to support this theory. Absolutely none. In fact, all the scientific evidence pointed in completely the opposite direction and said it was impossible for Gaitskell to have been poisoned. That didn't get in the way of MI5. So by the time Wilson gets into number 10 in 1964 as leader of the Labour Party and heading a Labour government, there was this established belief amongst some MI5 officers that he was, their phrase, a wrong'un, what Peter Wright called a snake in the grass, a bastard. And they began wondering how to get rid of him. Fast forward 3-4 years, and there's a, in the late mid to late 60s, there is a plot by right-wing business leaders and army officers, and depending whether you believe this or not, also involving Lord Mountbatten, to remove Wilson in what amounted to a coup d'etat. Wright was on the fringes of that plot, but it collapsed fairly quickly, and he certainly didn't get involved in it in any detail. MI5 senior management knew about it, but they did nothing to impede it. A few years and several general elections and special elections later, Wilson is back in number 10, and this is in 1973-74, and a much, much more serious plot was set in motion. And this time, Peter Wright was at its head. He was approached by some further right-wing businessmen who were upset by Wilson, not least by Wilson's association with some genuinely dubious East European emigres who had become very wealthy businessmen in the UK after trading with the Soviet bloc. And they wanted him removed. And they knew that the key to doing this was MI5's files on Wilson, the files that MI5 had been building up and which were held under a special code, if you like, in MI5's registry. And they said to Wright, tell you what, you leak them to us and we'll get them into the public domain and that'll scupper him. And Wright pondered this and thought about it and was tempted, but in the end, largely for reasons of self-protection, said no. That didn't stop him, however, from gestating his own plot. And his own plot was even less legal. In fact, it really amounted to treason. This is his own telling of the story, so it's not me making it up, it's not someone else attacking him. This is his own version of events. He decided that what should happen was that he should pull the files from MI5's registry, the files on Wilson, the files which detailed Wilson's association with these somewhat dubious businessmen, and he would go to Wilson and say, I'm going to use these, I'm going to leak them to the press, if you don't resign. In other words, he and a group of up to 30 other officers conspired and plotted to blackmail a sitting prime minister into resignation. Now, in the end, that plot too collapsed. But did Wright consider it? Did Wright plan it? Absolutely right he did, and we know that because he says so. We did this. MI5 knew about it. MI5 warned him gently not to do it, and he finally heeded that advice. So, and Thatcher would eventually, when she was pinned to the wall in Parliament by Wilson's successor, James Callaghan, said, no, it didn't really happen. It didn't. The new Director General of the Security Service has given me his personal assurance that none of this happened, that there were no plots, there were no files, nothing. Well, that was frankly a lie. And we know this not just because Wright says this, but because MI5 itself says, yes, there was a plot. There were several plots. Not for the first or the last time, Thatcher lied through her teeth in the House of Commons.
Thank you for that. Okay, we are going to take a second break and we'll be right back.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Let's move on to the Thatcher's government trying to suppress Spycatcher. Can you talk to us about sort of the lengths they went to and why we think they wanted to suppress the book?
So why did, the question obviously is, why did Thatcher and her consigliere, Sir Robert Armstrong, why were they so determined to silence Wright when they hadn't been determined, and the government, the previous governments had not been determined and had not attempted to silence other intelligence officers, nor had Thatcher and Armstrong or MI5 made any effort to stop Wright giving his television interview to the World in Action current affairs programme in 1984. Why did they suddenly, so it would appear, decide to launch litigation to prevent Spycatcher being published? I think the answer to that depends on who you choose to listen to. The British government's official arguments, which were set out in truly excruciating and repetitive affidavits by Sir Robert Armstrong, the Cabinet Secretary, who was also Thatcher's conduit to the intelligence services, were twofold. Firstly, that all members, Armstrong argued, of and former members of the security service owed an unbreakable lifelong duty of silence, that they could never, should never reveal publicly anything they'd learnt in the so-called secret services. And the second leg of his argument was that if they were permitted to do so, this would have a devastating effect on British intelligence and national security. The problem, and we've touched on it, was that far from being bound by this lifelong omerta, British intelligence had leaked like a sieve for decades. Whenever it suited MI5 to funnel information or misinformation and occasionally disinformation into the public sphere, its officers had been covertly encouraged to do just that. As Wright was one of them. He had done that at MI5's behest. And then, on top of that, all these retired spies had penned and published their memoirs, written articles, television interviews. No one had been stopped. Only Peter Wright was to be different. And that's where the other explanation emerges. When, decades late, and after much prodding by me, amongst others, Margaret Thatcher's prime ministerial files on the Spycatcher affair were dumped at the National Archives on New Year's Eve 2023.
Quite the present.
Yeah. They revealed the true genesis of her determination and that of Armstrong to silence Peter Wright. That motive was a shabby little plot which she and Armstrong had cooked up to gain political advantage. The plot had involved leaking, as we've said, the Hollis scandal to Chapman Pincher via a former Attorney General on Privy Council terms, in the belief that Pincher would give it a safe government-friendly spin. Once Number 10 discovered that Wright was planning to publish Spycatcher, Thatcher and Armstrong were faced with a dilemma. If they ignored the proposed book, as they'd done with pretty much everything else, that ran the risk that Wright would disclose yet more skeletons from within MI5 and Downing Street's closets. And bear in mind, when they discovered this, when they launched their action, they hadn't seen the book. They hadn't seen what it contained. The other option was to take legal action or attempt to block it. But that too posed a huge problem and a significant risk, because Wright lived in Tasmania beyond the reach of English criminal law. So if it wanted to silence him, the British government would have to confect a succession of ever more absurd civil law arguments. First injunctions, then actions for breach of supposed confidentiality. And the risk of this course of action, other than the fact that the government's own law officers advised privately that it had no chance of success, was that once legal battle is joined, the defendants, Wright and his publisher, had an absolute right of discovery to see the government's own documents. And those documents would very clearly expose Thatcher and Armstrong's collusion, backdoor collusion with Pincher, which, had it been exposed, as one of her MPs told me, could very easily have brought the entire government down. And that's why the documents I eventually got 7 months ago contain the explicit phrase relating to the papers about that plot: "This cannot be discovered." They knew. So Armstrong and Thatcher went to truly extraordinary and frankly absurd lengths to wriggle free from the mess. And in doing so, they dragged the government into international disrepute and opprobrium, day after damaging day.
And they made the book a bestseller in the end.
Yeah, I mean, again, that's one of the law of unintended consequences should be hammered into the heads of politicians and their oily civil servants. Mm. The publisher, Heinemann Australia, the publisher, when they commissioned it, thought, there's not much in this. Not unreasonably, since much of it had been published before. We think we probably might sell about 20,000 copies. Because of the government's action, and remember, it took action in Australia, New Zealand, Hong Kong, and wanted to take action in the United States, as well as the UK courts. Because of the government's actions, the book sold more than 4 million copies. That's the law of unintended consequences, yeah, writ large.
Yeah, indeed. And during that time, there were some sort of weird inconsistencies with regards to how people were treated when buying or selling copies. Because obviously it was published outside the UK, but some did manage to find their way into the UK during that time.
Oh, a lot. Mm. The main litigation was in Australia. That's where Wright was, that's where the publisher was, that's where the British government sued, attempting to get the book banned. And it dragged on, and the transcripts of the court hearing, which I got hold of, are, if you like that sort of thing, and I do, joyous, because they show Armstrong, who was the government's main, if not only witness, being absolutely crucified on the witness stand. But before the Australian litigation, the key litigation, could be concluded, an American edition of the book was published. American courts are completely beyond the reach of the British government. US Constitution explicitly protects freedom of speech, and courts then particularly had a habit of enforcing that. Once the American book edition was published, the cat was out of the bag. The genie was out of the bottle. The toothpaste was out of the tube. You pick your analogy. It was an instant bestseller. It hit the top of the US bestseller charts almost instantly, stayed there for 11 weeks. Thousands upon thousands upon thousands of copies were exported to the UK, where it was banned, and where British newspapers were banned by truly draconian injunctions from repeating any of Wright's allegations. But copies of the book just came in. People literally brought them in suitcases full at a time. One enterprising gentleman flew to New York, bought 100 copies for $3,000, and on the morning he arrived back at Heathrow, got the tube up to the Houses of Parliament, set up a stand on the pavement outside the Houses of Parliament and flogged the books at 100 quid a go. The whole farcical nature of this is at the time, literally at the time, British MPs in the House of Commons were being denied the right to debate. The saga, the debacle, the scandal, whatever you want to call it. And yet here was this bloke flogging American copies on the pavement outside the Houses of Parliament. Thatcher wanted Her Majesty's Customs to impound copies. She really have liked that. But her cabinet colleagues explained that really wasn't going to be terribly practical. And so reluctantly, she said, all right, well, we're not going to make any attempt to stop people importing it. And that led to commercial importation. I mean, literally tens of thousands of copies of this book appeared on the streets in people's homes within days and weeks of its US publication. At that time, no British journalist was able to report those allegations because the government had, or anything that Wright said pretty much, because the government had secured these injunctions. It was mad. It was utterly farcical. You know, when I started researching and then writing the book, the whole absurdist nature of the Spycatcher saga was slightly mind-blowing, really.
Mm.
You could have the book, you could import it, you could buy it, you could fill in a little mail order coupon and people would sell you the book and ship it to the UK, and that was all fine. But British libraries were prevented by injunction from putting the books on shelves. No, British readers can't read it in libraries. Oddly, the Thatcher's predecessor as leader of the Tory party, and indeed a former prime minister, Edward Heath, summed up the entire nonsense in a debate in the House of Commons in January 1987. He said, someone sent me a copy of the book, the US edition of the book, but I was told I shouldn't read it because I faced prosecution. But I was also told that if my housekeeper wanted to stand by the fire and read it to me, that would be all right. This is Alice in Wonderland stuff. This is, you know, it's... And there was so much more of this that it was almost like when I read the files and when I went back into these and located all this, it was like reading the libretto, the script for a Gilbert and Sullivan comic opera. It was just bonkers. You know, just as one's other small, because there are so many of these examples, at the same time as British journalists were prevented from reporting any of the contents of Spycatcher, by injunctions and by four newspapers and editors were charged with criminal contempt of court for having had the indecency to try and do so. At the same time, the British government had to, because it was contractually bound to, publish and put on sale the Journal of the European Parliament, which contained extracts from Spycatcher, which had been read out on the floor of Parliament in Strasbourg. So you had, on the one hand, and this is explicitly recognised in the government's own files, one arm of government saying, well, we're going to have to publish and sell this journal, which contains extracts from Spycatcher, and the other arm of government trooping back and forth to the High Court, to the Royal Courts of Justice in the Strand, securing a succession of injunctions and appeals against the lifting of injunctions to stop anyone reading, let alone reporting, those very same extracts. Utterly, utterly bonkers.
It is. It is indeed very bonkers. What is the sort of legacy of Peter Wright and Spycatcher today?
Again, that's one of the other great ironies. Just about everything the British government tried or said it wanted to achieve in seeking to ban Spycatcher and Peter Wright and silence Peter Wright, everything it sought to achieve, it achieved the absolute polar opposite. It said, you know, we're doing this to protect the security service and to maintain the morale of security MI5 officers. Well, the official history of MI5 says, no, it had the opposite effect. It actually dragged the service into international disrepute and damaged severely morale in the service. That was the easy bit. It said it wanted to prevent others like Peter Wright from publishing their memoirs. What it actually showed them was a route to do this. All they had to do was go to Australia, and the courts there, as the Spycatcher saga ultimately showed, would say, no, if you're revealing stuff that needs to be revealed, you can do it with impunity from here. Above all, Thatcher said, we must never have, her view, her argument, any form of parliamentary scrutiny of the intelligence services, nor should they ever be established in law. Well, Spycatcher ensured the opposite in both cases. It directly led to the MI5 and MI6 being put on a statutory basis for the first time, which stopped future Peter Wrights from bugging and burgling their way across London. And it led also directly, the Spycatcher saga, to the first ever parliamentary oversight and scrutiny of the intelligence services. The Security Intelligence Commission was created as a direct result. So everything the government tried to do in the Spycatcher saga, it achieved the absolute opposite.
What happened to Peter Wright in the end?
Wright, he and his lawyer, won in Australia in 1987 and won on appeal, and then won in the highest court in Australia in 1988. And the book came out in Australia. There have been newspaper accounts or claims that it made him a millionaire. It didn't. After deducting agents' fees and everything else, he made a tidy sum of money, and it genuinely lifted him and his wife, Lois, out of quite genuine penury. They were living in really heart-straitened circumstances until the money came through. He lived two or three more years after that. He was very sick throughout much of the trials. And trying to find out more about him as a person, which is, what I wanted to do, wasn't easy. I was very grateful that Paul Greengrass, his co-author, who's now a celebrated and award-winning Hollywood movie director, talked to me and was incredibly helpful. And eventually, one of Wright's daughters, Jenny Andrews, talked to me, and she was really useful. And it helped fill out the human picture of this man. The British government constantly sought to portray him as a man embittered by what had genuinely happened, which was the service denying him his full pension that he had been entitled to. He'd been promised. It reneged on that promise. And they tried to portray him as a greedy old man. What Paul Greengrass and Jenny Andrews, Wright's daughter, and Malcolm Turnbull, who was his remarkably effective lawyer, were able to do was to put that into, not just into perspective, but to say, no, that wasn't what drove the man. This was a man who, for all his faults, and he had those faults, was genuinely motivated by patriotism and by a belief which was, to some extent, if not largely, justified, that Soviet intelligence services had penetrated the British government, the civil service, and the British intelligence services. There was a very moving part at the end of his testimony, moving to me anyway, at the end of his testimony in Sydney in the court case. And he quoted Pope Gregory VII. He said, "I have loved my country and hated iniquity. Therefore, I die in exile." And that's exactly what happened to him.
Yeah, it's very sad. And one last sort of question, it may or may not be big. Is there anything else you'd like to add that's important to you about anything we've discussed today?
Yeah, and very briefly, if I may, we've talked around and mentioned that the files remain suppressed. Some were released. Some were released in remarkably odd circumstances. What I think we shouldn't lose sight of, and why this story matters today, is that there were 32 Cabinet Office files on the Spycatcher saga. They were created between 79 and 86. By law, they should have been released by December 2019. None of them have been. And the Cabinet Office has given a succession of misleading, false, and in some cases flat-out lying excuses for not having done so. They may or may not be released by 2029 if we're very lucky. Beyond them, there were 15 files that Thatcher's office, her private office, prime ministerial files, created on the saga. And I asked for them years ago. Again, they should have been released by 2019, which is when I began asking for them. And I was told, no, you can't have them. Can't have them. National security, no, absolutely not. Can't have them. And they told me that again in 2023, when I made a last despairing, September 2023, I made a last despairing attempt saying, look, I'm writing this book. You know, I should have that access to those files. No, you can't have them. Which made it rather odd that 3 months later, on New Year's Eve 2023, 3,200 pages from those files miraculously appeared in digitized form at the National Archive. And, you know, that was after I delivered the manuscript. Fortunately, I was able to get it back. I was able to annotate, fillet the files and reintroduce that information. But, and here's the bit which I think matters particularly. For all that time that all those files were withheld and remain in many cases withheld, two favoured tame writers were allowed access to them. One was a former civil servant writing the official history of the cabinet secretaries. We'll draw a veil over that for the moment. But the second was Charles Moore, former editor of The Spectator, The Daily and Sunday Telegraphs, a Tory, a loyal Tory to the tip of his brogues, and Margaret Thatcher's official biographer. He was not just allowed access to these secret files, in some cases still secret files, he was actually provided with them inside the Cabinet Office. Cabinet Office staff brought them up from the basement and said, there you are. He was allowed to quote from them. What were the conditions? Well, it's hard to know because neither Moore nor the Cabinet Office will talk about this, but he certainly gave them a friendly spin. And when I talked to Peter Wright's lawyer, Malcolm Turnbull, an incredibly able man who went on, we should remember, to become Prime Minister of Australia for 3 years. I told him this. I said, this is what's happened. Moore was allowed access to these and gave them a friendly spin. Turnbull, who's no stranger to the rough house of politics, was absolutely furious. He said, they're doing it again. They're doing with Charles Moore what they did with Chapman Pincher 40 years ago. Nothing changes. As he put it, the mendaciousness, the duplicity of these people is shocking. And that's why I think the story has a particular resonance today, because it isn't over. Because the same dirty tricks that they tried in the 1980s and which fell flat on their faces are being repeated in 2023 and 2024. And no one, I suppose, other than me or Malcolm Turnbull, is calling them to account. And I think that's wrong.
Yeah. Well, Tim, thank you very much for all that, and thank you for your time. Where can listeners find out more about you and your book?
My website, www.timtate.co.uk, has extracts from and explanations for all 19 of my published books, as well as freely viewable versions of a lot of my films. And it also has a contact page with my email address on it, and I'm always very happy to answer any questions from readers.
Fantastic. Well, I hope listeners do get a copy of To Catch a Spy. It's a very good book, and we've only just sort of scratched the surface of what's in there. So, Tim, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me.
For listening. This is Secrets and Spies.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.